Hello, Foreign Entanglements viewers. My name is Dr. Rob Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And with me today is Al Moroney of the Air War College in Montgomery, Alabama. How are you doing today, Al?
Doing great, thanks.
Cool. Could you introduce yourself a little bit more fully than I did and let us know what you do down there?
Sure. Currently, I'm the director of the Air Force Center for Unconventional Weapons Studies. We're part of Air University. We recently just moved from the Air War College to the Air Force Research Institute. The mission of our center is to educate both airmen and DOD and other government agencies on the critical issues relating to nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons as regards to military operations.
So what we're going to talk about today is going to focus around nuclear issues, sort of questions of nuclear modernization, questions of the triad. I wanted to give a, sort of an extremely brief overview of why. So the nuclear triad, as most people know, but just to fulfill, sort of refresh for some of the viewers who maybe don't, is typically regarded as submarine-launched ballistic missiles from nuclear ballistic missile submarines. Intercontinental ballistic missiles or other ballistic missiles, and aircraft launched or aircraft dropped nuclear weapons. And this triad is intended to give the nation a series of nuclear tools with which to carry out its deterrent policy. So one of the reasons we have the triad is so that a Soviet first strike could not wipe out the entire or every sort of nuclear weapon we have on the ground. Another reason we have it is because it is intended to give us additional tools. Some of the tools are more blunt. Some of the tools are more precise with respect to nuclear policy. Is that? Do you think that's a reasonable explanation of why we have the triad?
Well, the reason we have the triad is to ensure that we have adequate options for the president whenever there is a crisis of some nature across the range of military. Before I go too deep into it, I just want to put up a quick disclaimer that the views that I offer are my personal opinion and not those of the Air University, Air Force, or Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. But I will grant that the triad's beginnings back during the 50s and 60s were no doubt part of the competition between the services as a new form of warfare was being brought about. But over time, certainly the Army has dropped out of using nuclear weapons. The Navy has reduced theirs from, they got rid of their tactical nukes and now they have just strategic. There is a, has been a deliberate effort to identify the complementary parts of the triad as far as both deterring a general attack against the United States and assuring U.S. allies as to extended deterrence to assure them that the enemies will not threaten them with nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. and at the same time that they do not have to develop nuclear weapons of their own if they believe in the U.S. promises of extended deterrence. So the triad mission is a rather broad one, if you will. It does not do everything. It does not address nuclear terrorism. It does not address the a large number of options, but it does have a unique function as far as protecting the United States against a strategic attack.
Now, the reason that, and we're going to get into some sort of very contemporary issues with respect to Russia and Ukraine by the end of this, but the reason that people are talking a lot about the survival of the triad right now is because, broadly speaking, and with different shades on each part of the triad, all three elements of the triad, the ICBM force, the SLBM force, and the bomber force, are aging, right? The bomber force is B-1Bs that came into service in the 1980s, as well as B-2s. The ICBM force is old missiles that will be in need of replacement. And the submarine force also came into service in the 70s and 80s and will need to be replaced in very expensive fashion by 2030. Now, so in this context, I and others have made the argument that we can think pretty seriously about ditching at least one-third of the triad. And from my point of view, that would be the ICBM force. And I wrote about this. I'm pretty sure it was in The Diplomat. And you wrote an article at War on the Rocks that that challenged this view. I mean, I guess an explanation to a taxpayer of 2030 about why we are buying new ICBMs. What is it that this particular leg of the triad does in terms of giving the president's options and serving U.S. national security?
Sure. Just as a quick correction, the B-1Bs are actually not nuclear, part of the nuclear enterprise. It's just the B-2s and the B-52s. Thing about the B-52s, the youngest B-52 was first manufactured before I was born. And the way that the Air Force sometimes talks about it, they say that the last pilot of a B-52 has not been born yet. So we have a very old airframe, a very survivable and adaptable airframe that still could use some modernization when you go up against A2AD challenges, for instance, and the constantly evolving security posture that we have. I think it would be fair to say, when you look at military acquisition in general, certainly the propensity is for any weapon system to constantly be modernized. There's once a capability gap has been identified and somebody comes up with a widget, there's the tendency to say, okay, now we need to make it better. Now we need to upgrade it. We want to add new things to it. The ICBMs and the B-52s and the B-2s, for instance, have not been significantly improved, and the warheads that go with these delivery systems have not been modernized for over two decades, with the exception of some improvements here and there. But as far as a significant design increase, they have not been replaced by a more modern system. Now, some people will say, well, yes, these are Cold War relics. They're no longer useful. I sometimes think that is an incorrect statement to say, well, they're Cold War relics. They were designed during the Cold War, but certainly they still have missions today. Aircraft carriers were Cold War systems. The Abram tanks was a Cold War system. We still find uses for those. So when
one of the few post-Cold War systems we're actually fielding is the F-35, which remains has its own struggles.
True, and I'm not prepared to talk about the F-35 today.
Right.
That's a challenging issue, and well, it's certainly a top Air Force priority. But when you get to the modernization question, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of discussion about justifying what we're doing with those defense dollars, why we need a triad in the future. And the challenge comes on two parts. One is a physical consideration, and one is the operational consideration. The physical consideration, I think, is really not relevant. If from the point of saying, when you look at the modernization costs of improving a replacement for the Minuteman III, for instance, it is very, very small as compared to coming up with a new long-range strike bomber or a new Ohio-class replacement, for instance. The costs in an overall scheme of things are not considerable. When you look at how much we're paying out of the DOD budget, I won't get into the DOE budget. I'm not as familiar with that. But as far as the delivery systems, we're talking about a 1% of the defense allocation over the next 30 years. This is not significant. Colin Gray has pointed out in an old book of his, he said, if you are a serious student of strategy and you're looking for the United States approach to defense strategy, given that we have relatively safe borders and a big ocean between us and our adversaries, the first thing that you would want to modernize is nuclear forces. And the second thing would be naval and long-range air force. And in his opinion, the third would be tactical aircraft and ground forces. So I think there's on the fiscal side, there's not much to say we can't afford it. Well, of course we can. It's a very, very small of defense dollars, even though we are talking billions. There have been those critics that say it's $1 trillion over 30 years. I would suggest that they include a very large number of disparate items in that accounting. They're including missile defense. They're including demilitarization costs. They're including DOE costs. if just talking DOD, which is all we can do from a department, the fiscal side is not really the issue. Now, the operational side, there are think tanks like CSBA and CIS and I think even CNAS that, yes, every time they look at the nuclear triad, they say ICBMs have to go first. I don't personally understand the logic from this point. The reason we have the ICBMs is basically to make it very costly for an adversary to try to knock out our nuclear capability. As an antidote, one could say, if you've seen the movie Swingers, they go to Vegas and they're looking for a table to play at. And they say, hey, look at that table. There's all those good-looking people there. They go there and it's a $100 minimum bet at the table. So they get three chips. They look at each other and they end up saying, you know what, we've got to go to the $5 ante table because they can't afford to play at that table. It's almost the same thing with the ICBMs. What the ICBMs do is they say, okay, you're now at the $1,000 a play table. Any countries that can ante up for $1,000 per hand at blackjack, you can be a nuclear adversary. If we got rid of the ICBMs, we're basically limited to five bases, three bomber bases and two ICBM bases. Two naval bases. All of a sudden, that opens up a capability gap so that any adversary could walk in and say, all I got to do is take out five bases.
Al, but that's not true, right? Because the submarines don't sit at their bases, right? The submarines, several of the submarines are under patrol. Several of the submarines carrying dozens of warheads are on patrol at all times, right? So saying that they just need to take out these five bases. No, they need to take out these five bases, and they need to track down the nearly unfindable submarines that can strike from nearly anywhere in the world with a number of nuclear warheads that can make any degree of aggression completely, or can make the adversary pay for any degree of aggression completely beyond what any aggressor would be willing to pay, right? So it's not five bases. It's bases plus the actual submarines themselves.
Right, right. I understand that. But the submarines in and of themselves, as you say, they're nearly undetectable. It could be in the future that the Russians could come up with better technologies to track these submarines. The Chinese could be increasingly a player in getting into the anti-submarine efforts. They are still a limited commodity. They're in a very expensive commodity. The ICBMs give us a very visible and a very big deterrent to say, if you strike us, you better go all in, because the second strike is going to be massive. And
I've been on the USS Ohio when it was still an SSBN. It's a cruise missile submarine now. And when the submarine pulls into port, when one of these SSBNs pulls into port, it surfaces and it displays its capabilities of opening all of its missile tubes. And it does this intentionally to give Chinese and Russian satellites an indication that these submarines have this many missiles and could potentially fire this many missiles. I'm not sure what the visibility is doing here, right? How having a bunch of missile silos in North Dakota and South Dakota actually changes Chinese or North Korean or Russian behavior in any sort of meaningful way. I mean, the Russians aren't stupid. The Chinese aren't stupid. They know that these submarines are out there. They know that the stealth bombers are out there. They know that the chances of, even if they were to wipe out every ICBM, that the chances of them avoiding retaliation are virtually nil. The visibility doesn't really sell me on the need for the ICBM.
It's not just a question of visibility. I would argue that at some future point, if all we have are 10 submarines, not all of those subs are going to be out at sea at any given time because of rotation and maintenance and so on. That's still putting the odds on a very small amount of assets that you have out there. I'm not questioning that any one sub could do a good deal of damage if directed to by the president. But my point is this: what the submarines have been offered in the past is what we call a short second strike. And that's a good thing. What the ICBMs do is ensure that only the peer nations are going to be able to threaten the homeland with a nuclear attack. I think you could make the point that if a peer nation were able to track our submarines and take out even one or two of them out of the few that are out at sea, they could conceivably absorb the result of a one submarine's attack.
How many warheads does a Trident II carry, right, under the current arms control arrangements?
I don't know that.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that they're MIRV to four warheads. I could be wrong about that. I actually probably need to look that up. But that's...
I do know they do have to reduce the number of tubes they're going to carry under the new START, though.
Right.
So whatever they have now, it's going to be reduced after 2018.
So what you're suggesting is that four submarines carrying, say, 20 tubes each, and that then you wipe out two of those. And so any potential adversary is going to have to accept the likelihood of at least 40 nuclear warheads raining down on its territory. And these are 450 kiloton nuclear warheads that are going to be raining down on its,
sure,
on its territory, which for even Russia or China is going to amount to national suicide, right? It's going to amount to a greater cost than any nation in all of history has ever been willing to incur. And this assumes that they're able to knock out half of the submarines in advance.
Well, I'm not saying that they won't get their hair mussed, but...
I like that. That's good.
20, 30 million. It's not a question of would they be that crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of offering the president options to say if the intent is to have a safe, secure, and effective deterrent against a strategic strike against the United States, are the submarines enough?
Mm-hmm.
Our defense analysts suggest that it is not, that the submarines offer a good capability for a short second strike, but the ICBMs offer a sponge of sorts that would force an adversary to go all in, and it eliminates the smaller adversaries from seriously considering an attack against the United States.
Right, and I suppose I wonder if there is any adversary that we can conceive of in the world that would be willing to incur even the assured second strike of the Navy's SSBNs. It seems like a far greater risk. I mean, it's also interesting that during the 1980s and 1970s and 1980s, the ICBM force was, at least in a lot of circles, widely assessed to be much more vulnerable than the SLBM force, right? That the argument was always that the Russians might be able to knock out the ICBM force on the ground. But as I can take it, you're arguing now that it's the other way, that the SLBM force, maybe because of changes in technology or whatever, is actually more vulnerable now than the ICBM force?
I don't want to say that they're more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it comes into a question of capacity and roles, that they have complementary aspects here. They're not necessarily duplicative.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people are of the impression that, hey, they both come out of silos. What's the difference? They both carry warheads on a missile. They're the same thing. And I think that would be... an incorrect assessment,
mm-hmm,
to say what the ICBMs offer, they are hardened to a degree so that you can't use one missile to knock out an ICBM silo, for instance. You will probably need a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes to it comes to a math version that if you want to knock out all the ICBMs, you're going to need right now more than 500 missiles.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the United States is going to send you back a message in 30 minutes or your money back.
Mm-hmm.
The subs are a little bit more deliberate. They have to move to an area of the sea that they're supposed to operate in. They have one chance to come up and shoot their missiles, and then everybody knows where they are. Now, you may say, well, who cares at that point? You know, they've done their mission, and they can go home. But I think... one would say that a peer nation would still be looking for those subs, and the challenge is because they're not in the United States, they're not in the homeland,
mm-hmm,
that there is a degree of vulnerability. That's why they have to be so very quiet and very stealthy. But at the same time, the ICBMs, because of the numbers that they pose, they offset the vulnerability of being knocked out by the number that you would have to negate in the event of an attack.
I mean, isn't that even if I were to take that, and I guess I'm still not convinced, especially given the number of warheads that the boomers are capable of carrying, and the number of different places in the world that they're capable of operating, that they really sort of represent a more secure option. But couldn't you argue, and I think there's some evidence of this from the Cold War, that this is really a destabilizing logic that you're talking about, that the more we rely on ICBMs, the more we would convince potential adversaries to build more ICBMs of their own?
Well, not at all. I think I'm going to forget the author who suggested it, but the fact that two sides have nuclear weapons is not inherently destabilizing. As long as there's communications between these nations that say, yes, we have these assets. There are on-site inspections that go on between us and the Russians to at least examine our capabilities and make sure that we apply to treaties. These are all stabilizing actions to ensure that the Russian leadership knows that we have a certain capability and that we can use it. You say we can overwhelm it. Well, that was the Cold War model that says, yes, the Russian model was, yes, let's do as many megaton-sized missiles as we can to try to overwhelm the U.S. and try to get a first-strike advantage. We went up to, 30,000 nuclear weapons ourselves before we started pulling down. Mm-hmm. But we're not in the Cold War anymore. We're in a multipolar environment where we don't have just the peer nations. The submarines and the bombers in particular offer a better package for the smaller nations, if you will, to try to deter them from acting aggressively against their neighbors. The ICBMs will always be there in case of to counter the Russian military capabilities or Chinese if they continue to modernize. I guess one of the greatest concerns I think the ICBM force has is that part about the Russian and Chinese modernization. Certainly, the other nations of the world are not slowing down in modernizing their capabilities, both with ICBMs, with their submarines and bombers. Everything is being modernized to include their warheads. Ours are not. We have not modernized warheads since the warhead package for decades. Mm-hmm. We've modernized the non-nuclear components, and I believe that the intent is still to improve, for instance, the B-61 so that we have fewer B-61 modules and that's more logistically supportable. Mm-hmm. But as far as airframes, we have, less than 20 B-2 bombers and the B-52s.
I mean, although that's a little bit, the Chinese are updating their nuclear missiles because their nuclear missiles are still two generations behind ours, right? So they should be modernizing their nuclear missiles if they ever want. And their submarines are also two generations behind ours, and they're still flying bombers, Badger bombers, which are effectively the comparison to a B-47, right? So the Chinese are modernizing, but the Chinese should be modernizing. They'll continue modernizing in the future, and they'll catch us someday. The Russians are, I think, a more interesting question. I think the Russians are being sincere on this point, if no other, that one of the reasons they're modernizing their ballistic missile force is out of a concern of U.S. ballistic missile defense capabilities, right? And so that's why we see the Topol-M and other more advanced ICBMs, things that are supposed to defeat our own ballistic missile capabilities, right? And so that's something that we are not dealing with, at least at the same level as the Russians.
Right, but of course our missile defense capability is not designed to counter a Russian or Chinese nuclear attack.
Sure.
It's more for the one-offs, accidental launches, North Korean, Iranian aggression.
Sure.
I guess without drawing this out too long, I know we want to move on and talk about the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I think the point about the ICBMs is that we believe that it does offer a unique capability against a peer nation, And when the president puts out his guidance, since all military operations in essence need to address policy objectives that the administration has identified, mm-hmm. that we need to ensure that there are a full range of capabilities against any kind of crisis, to include the possibility of a Russian or Chinese full-out attack, first-use attack against the United States. As far-fetched as that is, that's not something that we want to disregard because of the possible consequences of that kind of attack. And if you believe that there's even a 1% chance of such an attack happening, certainly we need a modern capability to be able to dissuade an adversary from thinking about that, or at least committing very seriously to such a bargain.
Right, and I think that with a reliable second strike capability that is provided by the United States' fleet of ballistic missile submarines, the chance of something like that happen is a small fraction of 1%. But I do agree we should move on to question of the Ukraine. So, or Ukraine, not the Ukraine, because I know Ukrainians hate it when people refer to it as the Ukraine. So let's talk about some of these nuclear issues and relation to extended deterrence with respect to what's going on in Ukraine right now. Now, a lot of people are familiar with the story that Ukraine gave up. It's wrong to say that Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons because it never really had control over the weapons that were on its territory. But Ukraine eschewed any efforts to gain control of those weapons in essentially in exchange for territorial guarantees, and those territorial guarantees are now being violated. I mean, I guess, what do you see as the role of nuclear weapons in the current crisis, the crisis between NATO, the United States, and Russia? Like, where, even at the back of people's minds, are nuclear weapons looming in policy terms?
Sure. Well, I think as far as Ukraine, the U.S. nuclear deterrent or promises of extended deterrent do not apply to Ukraine in and of itself. There were no promises that we would protect Ukraine against a Russian invasion. You have pointed out correctly that there were promises of territorial sovereignty that obviously Russia has not lived up to. But there's no promise that we were ever going to offer NATO's nuclear umbrella over the Ukraine. Now, we can extrapolate forward from that to say, well, what if? What happens next? If Russia continues its aggression and takes the Ukraine and then continues on, then that's a different story. I think there's a bigger picture here to say, certainly what's happening in the Ukraine is unfortunate, and we need to keep in mind what the end state is. If the United States believes that Ukraine should be a neutral body that should not be influenced either by NATO or the Russians to make the Russians feel a little bit more comfortable in their near abroad, then that's one thing. And the nuclear weapons don't play any role in the guarantees of that or the discussion of that Ukraine's future. But let's suppose Russia says, you know what, I'm not happy with just having Ukraine. I want the Baltics back. I'd like to see the Warsaw Pact get back together. Then I think NATO has a very real concern. So we've been talking for a long time about why don't we get rid of the tactical nuclear weapons in Europe? What good are they? They just sit there. No one's seriously going to use it because Russia's not that interested. We're all over the Cold War. Why do we still have a nuclear capability there? And I think this is an important thing that NATO's going to have to discuss at their Wales meeting coming up to say, if the NATO nations want to remain a nuclear power, which they seem to do, what is our strategy in case Russia comes over the border? Russia still has tactical nuclear weapons. They still have missiles that could easily impact Europe.
If I could interrupt you for just for a second there, sure. on 2 points. One, Russia not only has tactical nuclear weapons, but they are a much more integral part of Russian warfighting doctrine with respect, yes, to a general European war than NATO's. And second, a statement that may be sort of really surprising to some viewers who aren't familiar with these issues, this issue that the argument that Europeans want these nuclear weapons there. the issue with respect to these nuclear weapons is extremely complicated. And it is true that the nuclear weapons are generally unpopular with the publics in these NATO countries, but are extremely popular with the militaries and the sort of security infrastructures in the countries. And we can actually talk a little bit more about that in a second, but why don't you continue?
Sure. And that's a very good point, that the governments in NATO believe that they still want a nuclear capability. And the United States offers part of that nuclear capability, but also is supported by the air forces of other countries in various forms of logistic support and ISR and other air missions. So I think that we can argue about whether or not the number of tactical nuclear weapons is useful at all or not in the case of Russian aggression or how they would be used. But certainly they influence the calculus of a potential Russian attack into the Balkans, into the Baltic states. Mm-hmm. If Russia makes that gamble, they've got to at least consider the fact that NATO is going to start signaling things, that they're going to start exercising their dual-capable aircraft and getting them ready for a response if Russia starts pushing into NATO countries. Mm-hmm. This becomes very political very quickly. If NATO declares that they're under attack by Russia, certainly the nuclear weapons are going to be a part of that to ensure the survival of those countries. Mm-hmm. When that happens is another question. When the president talks to the other European Union countries, they'll have to come to an understanding of how those nuclear weapons would be used. But in the meantime, it is a promise that we made so that Germany would not make its nuclear weapons, so that Spain or Italy and Turkey would not start creating nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. The fact that we have a nuclear capability over there helps our commitment to the non-proliferation treaty and at the same time offers some security promises against a Russian incursion into a NATO country.
Now, somebody was recently arguing, and I want to say it was Tom Nichols who was making the argument. I could be wrong about that, though. Was making the argument that the tactical nuclear weapon capability is a crutch for NATO governments that don't want to spend more than 2% on their defense, right? And so that, in fact, maybe you don't want to get rid of it right now in the middle of this crisis because that would display weakness in front of the Russians, whatnot. But in the long term, that the Germans should not be convinced that they can spend whatever they spend right now on their defense and be secure. That, in fact, for NATO to work, we do need to push everybody back up to around 2%. And that the best way to do that is to remove this guarantee of tactical nuclear weapons. Because, I mean, this not being the Cold War anymore, right? I mean, in the Cold War, the Red Army was effectively, in conventional terms, unbeatable, or at least we really largely believed it. But now it's not, right? And so with a reasonable NATO conventional commitment, you could defend NATO's territorial integrity. So, I mean, do you have an opinion on that argument?
I have an opinion.
It's your opinion, not the opinion of the Air Force or the government or anything else. So.
Yes, yes. I think that the 2% argument is a dangerous one to make. It is a metric of sorts, but I think I've just read recently somebody made the observation that Norway spends less than 2% on their budget, but they have a very effective military. Mm-hmm. Other nations spend over 2% and they're not so effective. So it depends what you're bringing to the table. And certainly, NATO does have a very capable conventional capability right now. They probably could be spending more, but that's politics. They've got to balance that and have that discussion with their populations. But the nuclear side, yes, this is bad timing to try to take anything off the table. But I'll offer that the Russians have already said, hey, Poland, if you're putting missile defense sites in your nation, guess what? We're going to target that with nuclear weapons. You are going to be a target. Doesn't matter whether or not the missile defense capability seriously affects Russia's capability. They feel threatened by it, and their response is to use nuclear weapons. As you've pointed out, because of Russia's less than capable conventional capabilities, they feel the need to have nukes to augment that. much as we did in the 50s and 60s. So given that scenario, until the Russians have a more adequate conventional capability and pull out their tactical missiles, it's somehow, in my opinion, foolish to say that you can counter a nuke with a conventional capability. There's just no comparison. Even if you're talking a 1 kiloton nuke, the equivalent of that is dropping 1,000 Mark 84 bombs at one time on one spot, let alone something of a 20, 30, 100 kiloton attack. There is no comparison between a nuclear a strike and a conventional strike. So if you want to deter the Russians from using their tactical nukes, saying, hey, we've got JDAMs and we're going to knock out your communications, they're going to say, okay, fine. Guess what's coming back? Mm-hmm. We have to match like with like, especially with nuclear weapons, because the devastating effects of even a tactical nuke is not sufficient to say, well, we've got to counter if with conventional weapons. Now, I'll say that the Nuclear Posture Review talked about reducing the role of nuclear weapons in operations. I'm all for that, sure. As long as we have an overwhelming superior conventional capability, we do not need to rely on nuclear weapons so much in an offensive operation. But to deter an adversary from using nukes against us, nothing but another nuke is going to be adequate to make them have that calculus, in my opinion.
Right. I mean, it's also worth, I think it's worth noting and worth pointing out again, especially in context of this crisis, that, you know, I think that there are plenty of very sensible interpretations of Russian behavior that still sort of can grant and recognize that Russia has not acted in a completely unrestrained manner so far. At the same time, they clearly view the restraints of international law much differently than we do, right? And so this talk about what might happen with tactical, these are not absurd questions, right? These are not questions we should just immediately write off as completely impossible, especially sort of where tactical nuclear weapons are concerned. Do you have any more observations? Anything else we want to talk about before we go, or any parting thoughts?
Just in parting thoughts, I think the Air Force has tried hard over the last several years, considering the several crises that it's found itself in, to improve the nuclear enterprise. The Secretary of the Air Force is very earnest in her desire to improve the nuclear enterprise and to act upon the reviews that have been offered up over the last year or two. I think the Air Force has a very important role to play in the nuclear deterrent, and they want to do what's smart for the Department of Defense as well for the United States in ensuring, if the president has a crisis, that we offer tools that are responsive to a great many different calculuses. The thing that I guess disturbs me the most is when people keep throwing the term Cold War relic around. In my opinion, again, I think that there's a component of the arms control community out there who doesn't want to get out of the Cold War. They keep thinking that the only option that we have is a catastrophic response that all hit the button, everything flies into the air, and we create the nuclear winter that destroys the world. That is so 1992. Given we're in a multipolar world today with multiple nuclear capable states and a much more complex security environment, I think what you're going to see with the Air Force is a desire to come up with a what you've seen is meeting the U.S. commitments to the treaties and agreements, as well as modernizing the capabilities to have smaller, more focused, more tailored responses to a new conflicts that we can see in the operating future. Everybody, I think, on my side of the fence knows that the Cold War is over. Mm-hmm. Everybody's interested in modernizing and offering a credible capability. And if you don't modernize your capability, people are going to say, your airframe 80 years old. Your warheads were designed in the 1960s. Who knows if they work anymore? We don't test them in the open air anymore. I'm going to call your bluff. I don't think you have a credible military capability. We do not want to be stuck in that and that environment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
So we, and I that's mean, all I've got. I'll let you have the last
entirely reasonable. You know, I mean, even though the Chinese are currently aiming missiles at us that are, you know, basically the equivalent of stuff that we built in the early 60s and that they're flying Badger bombers, I mean, I don't doubt the credibility of their commitments, of the credibility of their nuclear deterrent, right? And I, you know, just because we're not modernizing, I don't really see the Russians or the Chinese as doubting the credibility of ours. The credibility comes from other sources. And so I guess I'm still skeptical about the needs for all three levels of the triad. But, well, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation, and hopefully we'll have you on again at some point.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.